"By all means marry," he said. "If you get a good wife, you'll be a happy man. If you get a bad one, you can always become a philosopher." I don't know into which category Solomon placed himself. He certainly had enough wives, according to the Bible, to have plenty of experience of what it was like to be married. But certainly this song that bears his name, the Song of Solomon, that we've been looking at last week and this week, among the many other things which it seeks to achieve, it's certainly a powerful affirmation of the happiness of the married state. That's one of the things, without any question, that the author's trying to get across to us. Those of you here last week will, I hope, recall that we went through some of the various lines of interpretation which commentators have adopted in trying to understand this very controversial book over the centuries. And I offered you the opinion that it's best regarded as a kind of dramatic oratorio with two principal characters, a man, and in the New International Version, his words in the song are designated those of the lover, and a woman, who is designated the beloved in the NIV. And in addition, there are occasional interruptions by a chorus, whom the NIV calls the friends. And I suggested too that the structure of this oratorio is symmetrical, arranged around a central stanza at chapter 4, verse 16, and chapter 5, verse 1. The first half of the book deals with the period of courtship leading up to the honeymoon night after the wedding. And then the second half of the book deals with the story of the early days of the marriage, which, as is so often the case, didn't go totally smoothly. Well, this evening we're going to take up the Song of Solomon again, beginning in that second half of the book at 5 verse 2. And I've outlined the three sections that comprise this second half of the book: a lover's tiff, making it up again, and married bliss. Let's start with the lover's tiff. Chapter 5, verse 2. "I slept, but my heart was awake. Listen, my lover is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my flawless one. My head is drenched with dew, my hair with the dampness of the night. I've taken off my robe, must I put it on again? I've washed my feet, must I soil them again?" Now, as I say, this is a scene from early married life. A temporary breach is going to be caused between the lovers, and it's not an unfamiliar scenario. The girl is in bed in her private apartment. It wasn't unusual in a fairly wealthy establishment in the ancient Near East for a woman to have her own room in this way. In the middle of the night, her new husband knocks on the door. He wants to make love. "Come on, darling," he says, "I'm feeling really steamed up, sweating buckets here just thinking about you." But the girl is reluctant, you see. She's tired. She's had a bath. She's nice and cozy under the sheets. Some suggest her lassitude is a coy pretense, but I don't think the passage actually suggests that. No, she's just not in the mood for sex at the moment, you know. Women sometimes aren't. But the man is persistent. He tries everything he knows how to get that door open. "My lover thrust his hand through the latch opening," tries to get his hand inside to open the door from the outside. At least that's the superficial meaning of the text. Some commentators point out that there is some grounds for thinking that in Hebrew idiom, the hand was sometimes a euphemism for the male sexual organ. So they suggest there is a very erotic double entendre here. Anyway, eventually the girl begins at any rate to get aroused by his importunity. Desire begins to stir. "My heart began to pound for him. I arose to open for my lover. But my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with flowing myrrh on the handles of the lock," she says. Once again, that reference to hands dripping with myrrh lends itself to double entendre, which I'll leave to your imagination. But the surface meaning of the text is that this girl has put on the oil of Ulay night cream, and her hands are greasy, and they slip on the handle of the door, and so it delays her getting it open. When at last she does manage to turn the key, she finds to her chagrin that he's gone. Peeved, no doubt, by her unresponsiveness, he's thrown a typical male sulk and gone off into the night. Sexually frustrated males do this kind of infantile thing, as every married wife or married woman knows. Well, in her agony of consternation that he should have gone off in this way, she rushes out into the street, you see, to look for him. I looked for him but didn't find him. I called for him but he did not answer. My lover had left. He was gone. Then the watchmen found me as they made their rounds in the city. This band of soldiers on patrol seemed to sexually harass this poor woman as she's vainly looking for her loved one. Verse 7. They beat me, they bruised me, they took away my cloak, those watchmen of the walls. So she wails to the chorus for help. O daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, if you find my lover, what will you tell him? Tell him I'm faint with love. In other words, get a message to my husband somehow. Please, tell him I'm not too tired to make love anymore. I'm faint now, not with weariness, but with desire. And then the poet takes the opportunity, while she's, we're to imagine her wandering around looking for him, to develop a rather beautiful eulogy of her lover in verses 9 to 16. It's quite clear that in her mind, from head to foot, he's every inch an Adonis. Verse 10, my lover is radiant and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000, or one in a million, as I suppose we would more colloquially put it. But she's lost him. Which way did he go? The chorus plead in chapter 6, verse 1. We'll help you to look for him. Which way did your lover turn? When she replies, she does so cryptically, in words which are actually a plaintive echo of earlier words from the Song of Solomon. The first phrase from the premarital erotic fantasies in which she, remember, she engaged in chapter 2, verse 16, and the second from the sexual invitation which she offered to her bridegroom on their honeymoon night. My lover has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to browse in the gardens and to gather lilies. I am my lover's and my lover is mine. He browses among the lilies. There are two ways of taking this. Either it's intended as wistful nostalgia. In her chagrin, in her loss, she's recalling to mind those dreams of what it was like when he was around, feeling thoroughly fed up with herself to have lost him. But I think more likely, we're intended to conclude at this point in the song that the lover has actually reappeared on stage. The emergency is over. He's back. The sense of alienation is short-lived. The girl's panic is drowned now in the relief of their reunion. And so the second section begins, making it up again. Chapter 6, verse 4. You are beautiful, my darling, as Tirzah, lovely as Jerusalem, majestic as troops with banners. Turn your eyes from me, they overwhelm you. This is the husband speaking, the lover. Quite clearly, he's had second thoughts. Maybe he's had a cold shower, and he's feeling a little bit more sober now. He's realized what a unique beauty he's got. And in words that, again, rekindle memories of that honeymoon night, he tells her how she absolutely knocks him out. You're the only one for me, he says, verse 8. 60 queens there may be, and 80 concubines, and virgins beyond number, but my dove, my perfect one, is unique. If the lover is Solomon himself, as many people think, then this may very well be a literal reference to the rest of his harem. A bevy of royal beauties, to be sure, but not to be compared with his beloved. Alternatively, though, I think you could equally take this reference to the harem as just figurative. He's saying, I reckon you're one in a million too. Only the most exalted images of celestial glory, he says, will suffice to praise you. Verse 10. Who is this that appears like the dawn, fair as the moon, bright as the sun, majestic as the stars in procession? He's got a real way with words, this Lothario, isn't he? You want to know what I did when I went off earlier in the night in that huff? Oh, he says in verse 11, I went down to that grove of nut trees. It reminded me of those days when we, in our courtship, used to wander around in the countryside. Made me feel strangely distracted and impulsive. You know, without thinking about what I was doing, I suddenly found myself jumping into one of the chariots down there that are kept. I've got an idea,
Let's go out for a joyride in it. So that's what they do. The scene changes. The young couple are now in the chariot, ready to leave, and the chorus are singing, come back, O Shulamite. Shulamite, I think, probably simply a feminine version of Solomon. O woman of Solomon, come back, that we may gaze on you. In other words, we haven't seen enough of your beauty yet. But her lover mocks their appeal. You just want to ogle her, he says, like spectators watching an attractive girl dancing at the disco. We have more important things to do than titillate your eyeballs. And as they race away in the chariot, he begins to talk much more privately and confidentially to his wife. And what follows in chapter 7, I think, has to be, without doubt, the most explicit and intensely erotic section of the entire song. The young lover surveys the physical charms of his wife, inch by inch, slowly and meticulously, starting at the feet and working upwards. When he gets to verses 7 and 8, well, the imagery could scarcely be more sensual or explicit, could it? Your stature is like that of the palm, your breasts like clusters of fruit. I said I will climb the palm tree and will take hold of its fruit. No mistaking what he means by that. If she thinks this is very bold, she certainly doesn't say so. She's not going to reject his advances this time. On the contrary, she's got plenty of ideas of her own on that score. The beloved starts to reply, verse 10. I belong to my lover, and his desire is for me. Come, my lover, let's go to the countryside. Let's spend the night in the villages. While we're in this chariot, let's make a weekend of it, she says. Let's go to one of our rural hideaways that we discovered on our honeymoon. I promise you, you won't have any doubts at all about the intensity of my passion for you when the night's over. So they do, verse 12. Let's go to the early vineyards to see if the vines have budded, if their blossoms have opened. The mandrakes send out their fragrance, and at our door is every delicacy, both new and old, that I have stored up for you, my lover. There's a fascinating little aside in chapter 8. She says to herself, what a bore it is that I have to control myself in company. If only you were my brother, I wouldn't have to conform to such patterns of social propriety. If you were my brother, I'd be free to show my affection to you in public, and no one would be offended. As it is, we'll have to go back to my mother's house to be alone together, just like when we were going out in the spring of our romance. There we'll rediscover the bliss of our young love, she says. His left arm is under my head, verse 3. His right arm embraces me. So the second part of the second movement comes to an end, and the concluding section of the song begins. The bliss, an ode to the bliss of married love. The chorus begin this one. This time they've changed from being the daughters of Jerusalem waving goodbye to the chariot, and have now become a party of friends and relatives back home in the up-country residence where the young couple originally hail from, who are watching when they arrive. Who is this coming up from the desert, leaning on her lover, they ask. They don't recognize her at first. This romantic young couple arriving so unexpectedly from the wilderness, who are they? The girl, she's excited to see a familiar spot as she arrives, an apple tree near her bridegroom's home, rich with memories both of his childhood and their courtship. Under the apple tree I roused you, and there your mother conceived you, she says. And it seems that suddenly, under this wave of nostalgia, at returning to the place where their love was new, she suddenly becomes very urgent and imperative and serious, verses 6 and 7. Place me like a seal over your heart, she says, like a seal over your arm. For love is as strong as death, its jealousy unyielding as the grave. It burns like blazing fire, like a mighty flame. Many waters cannot quench love, rivers cannot wash it away. If one were to give all the wealth of his house for love, it would be utterly scorned. In other words, she's saying, listen, what we have got is invaluable and imperishable. So please don't torture me with the thought that you might leave me again like you did that night. I couldn't bear it. Swear to me that our relationship is going to be a permanent one. Make me like that pendant you wear around the neck, or that bracelet you wear on your arm, marked with your personal insignia and never separable from your body, exclusively your own, she says. For a love like ours is too precious to gamble with. It's as irresistible in its compulsion as death. It's as implacable in its possessiveness as hell. It's as passionate in its ardor as a supernatural inferno. Many waters, no amount of water, could douse this flame or divert its course. No amount of money could suffice to purchase it. What we have is invaluable and imperishable, she says. So please, promise you'll never leave me. Well, the friends are then introduced again, the chorus, to lighten this rather intense and serious mood. We have a younger sister here, and her breasts are not yet grown. What shall we do for our sister for the day she's spoken for, they ask. They're pointing to some young maiden in their midst. She is a bit like the beloved was perhaps 10 or 15 years before, beautiful but still sexually immature. No man has yet come seeking her hand in marriage. What's the best thing we can do for a girl like her, they ask. Then they answer their own inquiry, verse 9. If she is a wall, we will build towers of silver on her. If she is a door, we will enclose her with panels of cedar, they say. In other words, fortify and protect her against violation. That's what we must do. And the beloved replies, yes, taking up the same metaphor and adapting it to herself. I am a wall and my breasts are like towers. Thus I have become in his eyes like one bringing contentment. In other words, she's saying, I have been chaste like that. I have been pure. I've found the one person to whom I want to surrender myself. My Mr. Right, if you like. And I brought him contentment. It's a lovely word. The Hebrew word shalom, peace. It's a word, I think, that points forward beyond the turmoil, the heady passion of young love, and recognizes already the advance of a more tranquil satisfaction in their married relationship. She has brought her spouse contentment, peace, because of the voluntary and unreserved way she's been able to give herself to him. And that's very much the theme of the closing verses. Solomon had a vineyard in Baal Hamon. He let out his vineyard to tenants. Each was to bring for its fruit 1,000 shekels of silver. But my own vineyard is mine to give. The 1,000 shekels are for you, O Solomon. For those, again, who think of Solomon as the literal hero of this story, this is a reference to the fact that he bought a vineyard adjacent to this woman's vineyard up in the north country and rented it out, and that was how they first met. But it could equally well be just a metaphorical allusion to the way in which all of us are sovereign over our own property. Solomon rightly demands rent for the vineyards he owns. Well, says the woman, I have a vineyard of my own. There's again a double meaning here. She has a literal vineyard up in those hills, which we learned in chapter 1 she tended. That's her own vineyard. She does what she wants with the money it produces. But there's a metaphorical sense too, for vineyard has often been used in the Song of Solomon as a metaphor for her sexuality. That's mine too. My vineyard is my own to give. And I've chosen who I want to give it to. To my Solomon, my Don Juan, my husband. Except that is for the small gift that I've set apart for my friends, the 200 shekels, these friends who've looked after my vineyard in my absence down in Jerusalem. So the chorus are given their opportunity to bow and maybe take up a collection. I'm not sure whether that was the original significance of the 200 shekels. And the two principal characters are left on the stage to take their bow and say their final lines. The lover asks his wife for a final refrain, and she, appropriately enough for such a poem, echoes the very sensual invitation to her husband to prove his virility, which once before in the song she had dreamed of. Come away, my lover, and be like a gazelle or like a young stag on the spice-laden mountains. Well, I think you'll agree it's a very remarkable poem. There's nothing like it in the rest of the Bible, is there? What lessons are we to learn from it? Last week we began by pointing out one or two preliminary lessons that could be gained from a book like this. This evening I'll just add a few more to it, specifically thinking about marriage. First thing, it seems to me, the Song of Solomon makes very clear is the importance of sex to marriage. Now, of course, it's true that in our modern age there is a certain degree of obsession with sex. We spoke about that last week. And people often, therefore, exaggerate its importance. But it is equally possible for Christians, perhaps brought up in a sheltered and inhibited atmosphere, to grossly underestimate the importance of sex in marriage. Sexual frustration, in fact, can be a cause of marital disharmony, as the Song of Solomon points out to us in that opening incident of chapter 5 that we looked at. In fact, according to Jack Dominion, an expert psychologist on marital counselling, the irritation of the lover in finding his loved one unresponsive to his advances is extraordinarily common, and one which arises again and again in marital counselling. Perhaps I'll read to you just briefly a little piece that was written for him by one husband who was feeling a bit peeved in that way. "To my ever-loving wife, during the past year I have attempted to seduce you 365 times. I succeeded 36 times. This averages once every 10 days. The following is a list of excuses made on the unsuccessful occasions. We will wake the children, 7. It's too hot, 15. It's too cold, 3. Too tired, 19. It's too late, 16. It's too early, 9. Pretending to be asleep, 33. The windows are open and the neighbours will hear, 3. Backache, 16. Toothache, 2. Headache, 26. Giggling fit, twice. I've had too much to drink, 4. I'm not in the mood, 21. The baby is crying, 18. I watched the late TV show, 12. I have a mud pack on my face, 18. You are too drunk, 9. We have company in the next room, 7. Your parents are staying with us, 5. My parents are staying with us, 5. Is that all you ever think about, 105. Now, of course, there is a reason for this. The Kinsey Report, a very famous report on sexual behaviour, found out, confirmed very clearly, that male and female sexual responses are very different. But we don't always imagine that they are. We don't always understand they are. Sexual desire, for instance, in a woman tends to follow a monthly cycle with a low point during ovulation. It also takes much longer for sexual desire to be aroused in a woman than in a man. Whereas the man can be switched on almost like an electric light just by a little physical or visual stimulation, most women require an atmosphere of tenderness and intimacy preparatory to making love. And the failure of a husband and wife to understand this differences of response pattern and make allowance for it is a very frequent cause for a great deal of misunderstanding and frustration in the early days of marriage. It's exactly the scenario the Song of Solomon so wisely portrays. It happens all the time. The lover's tiff is all too common. So the Song of Solomon is a very necessary reminder that sex is important to a marital relationship, and we ought not to take it for granted. I, for one, am glad these days that there are more books available written by Christians with Christian standards of sexual purity in mind, which are intended for couples who want to understand one another's sexuality and be better sexual partners for one another. If you're interested in knowing some of the titles of those books, I can offer a couple of suggestions to you. Incidentally, it's worth noting, while we're still talking about this question of the importance of sex in marriage, that in the Song of Solomon, there's a great deal of reciprocity between the male and the female in the initiative to make love. Love is by no means the by no means the dominant sexual partner. The woman, as you will often see, is just as forward and just as provocative in inviting her husband's sexual advances, sometimes embarrassingly abandoned, in fact. So she's certainly no passive or frigid young lady, this beloved. And any who still live with the sort of Victorian notion of the passive woman's role in sex, well, the Song of Solomon doesn't really agree with that. The other thing that's worth noting, incidentally, is that there's no interest at all in the Song of Solomon in children. That doesn't mean, of course, that the Bible's not interested in children. Undoubtedly it is. But the Song of Solomon is faithful to the creation order of Genesis, where it insists that a marriage is complete without children. This woman doesn't have to bear a child before she can be the real wife of her husband. On the contrary, they are complete together. The importance then of sex to marriage, that's the first thing that's worth noting from this book. You won't find all that many passages in the Bible which speak about that quite so frankly, so it's worth taking note of it. The second thing that's worth drawing from the Song of Solomon is the importance of words to marriage. Now, this is just as important as what I've just said. If it's usually the husband who complains of sexual dissatisfaction in marriage, equally, it is often the woman who complains of a lack of verbal communication in marriage. He just sits in the chair and watches the TV, she complains. He never talks to me. Then when we get into bed, he expects me to be passionately interested in him. Doesn't work. The word used, says Jack Dominion, is the word most frequently uttered by wives of all social circumstances in such situations. I feel used. It all comes back, of course, to what we said earlier about the difference between male and female sexual responses. Talking is a vital factor in creating that atmosphere of tenderness and intimacy, which for a woman is absolutely vital. In that connection, it's fascinating to observe the way the poet of the Song of Solomon constructs so much of his poem in the form of a dialogue between the lovers. He doesn't describe what they are doing with one another. He's much more interested in what they are saying to one another. For him, that's very, very important to love. Now, that fits in again very, very well with what modern marital counsellors would recognise. For they would say one of the most important things which a marriage does for us is to consolidate our self-esteem. Many men and women, unfortunately, are thrown into life with a very inadequate sense of their own worth and lovableness. And in the providence of God, the intimacy of marriage provides a very special environment in which that situation can be repaired. All of us know that a man or a woman who feel deeply loved by their spouse have enormous resources of emotional resilience to draw on. They tend to be more confident people, more secure people. And words play an absolutely essential part in communicating that sense of self-esteem. See, the lover tells his beloved what a great girl she is. He never tires of telling her. And she tells him the same. It really matters. They say, you know, that marriage is the highest compliment a man can pay a woman. Unfortunately, it's usually the last compliment he pays. At least it is in many marriages. The importance of words, then. That, too, it seems to me, is a very important lesson. A third important lesson that arises very directly out of those verses we looked at in chapter 8, verse 6, is the importance of promises to marriage. Place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal over your arm. See, one of the things you have to realize about sexual passion is that it can be very fickle. It feels very unreliable. It's nonsense to say you can only fall in love with one person, you know. It's just not true. You can fall in love with any number of people if you let yourself. And we all know that. And that's why An intense relationship between a man and a woman is very difficult to sustain without promises. Promises are a way in which we commit ourselves to being predictable in this relationship. That we're not going to be blown away by the fickleness of passion. All too often, I'm afraid, you know, in a marriage, the relationship fails to be deep and satisfying because there is no sense of promise. Without a sense of promise, neither party can really afford to take the emotional risk of total self-giving to the other. What happens if she deserts me? I should be unendurably shattered. So a marriage without promises must always be a marriage with reservations. The potential victim to destructive suspicions and doubts. You dare not commit yourself, your hopes, to a person you can't fully trust, and you can't fully trust a person whose future responses can't be reliably predicted. And only the promise gives us any guarantee about those future responses. That's why the woman says, "Place me like a seal over your heart." She's felt for one terrible moment the agony of separation. She knew how devastating that was, how it tore her apart emotionally. She doesn't want to feel like that again. She knows how powerful this love that binds a man and a woman is. As strong as death, as possessive as the grave, burning like a blazing fire. It won't be put out. So for goodness sake, she says, make promises to me. Wilt thou have this woman to thy wedded wife, to live together after God's ordinance in the holy estate of matrimony? Wilt thou love her, comfort her, honour and keep her in sickness and in health, and forsaking all others, keep thee only to her, so long as you both shall live? The man shall answer, I will. These days those promises are increasingly disregarded. But there will never be a romance in any of our lives like the romance of the Song of Songs without a promise like that to bind it. The fourth lesson I draw from the Song of Songs, and particularly these verses that we've just been reading in chapter 8, is the importance of premarital chastity. This little aside about the young sister. What shall we do for her, you know? Protect her, says the chorus, so she isn't violated. Make sure that her virginity is defended. If she is a door, enclose her with panels of cedar. Why does the Bible generally, and the Song of Solomon in particular, feel so strongly about that need to protect the chastity of unmarried men and women? Well, I suspect the answer, again, has to do with the appreciation which the Song of Solomon has of this inseparable nature of the bond which sexual love creates. The book of Genesis talks about a man and a woman becoming one flesh. It's a very powerful phrase, that, isn't it? It implies an organic union from which there can be no return. When you sleep with somebody, you become a part of them, and they become a part of you, one flesh. You can never reclaim that mutual investment you've made in one another. This is the reason Eros is such a fiercely possessive love, because once you've engaged in it, you have given a bit of yourself away. This is why divorce is so emotionally devastating, because that one flesh bond cannot be severed without profound psychic disturbance to our whole personality. A married couple are bound together by interpersonal superglue. There can be no separation without pain and a tearing sense of loss and an incomparable sense of inner devastation and emptiness and deprivation. And that, it seems to me, is the most powerful argument for premarital chastity. See, people talk about casual sex, but there is no such thing. All sex is serious. People talk about extramarital sexual intercourse. There is no such thing, really. But the very idea is a contradiction in terms. Sexual intercourse in the Creator's plan creates a marital situation. A couple who sleep together may avoid the legal ramifications of marriage, but those are minor. Those are trivial.
They can't avoid the emotional and personal one flesh bond, which in the Creator's plan, such union creates. Paul even says in 1 Corinthians 6, that when a man has as casual a relationship as that with a prostitute, he becomes one flesh with her. So again, when a couple engage in sexual relations, they're giving themselves to one another and they will never be the same again. You can commit murder or theft in cold-blooded objectivity. But sexual behaviour, whether you want to or not, always involves you. That's the mystic power of Eros that has made it the idol of so many cultures. As I say again, it is the most powerful of all arguments for premarital chastity. You may say, we're not ready for marriage yet. Well, if you mean by that you're not yet ready to be bound by a legal contract to one another, how on earth can you pretend that you're ready to be bound by that much more inseparable and permanent one flesh bond? For I assure you, that is the far more important step. At least it is in God's book. There is a sense in which marriages are not made at the altar at all. They are made in bed. When a couple go to bed together, then they just better be ready for marriage, because if not, they're giving themselves to one another in a way they can never reclaim and which they may regret if they ever want to get out of that relationship. What's more, the day may come when they will want to give themselves to somebody else and find that that relationship is spoiled by inescapable memories and invidious comparisons, and by the fact that they have already given bits of themselves away, which are no longer available to invest in that one special person. If she is a door, then we will enclose her with panels of cedar. This woman was glad that she had kept her chastity till she found her Solomon. And one final point, the importance of personal choice in marriage. Now, I may be wrong about this, but I have a strong suspicion that the Song of Solomon is partly intended to be a cautionary warning against the abuse of the so-called arranged marriage. In ancient Eastern society, in fact still today in Eastern society, it is a common practice for the parents to select the wife for their son. And it certainly was the case in Solomon's day that kings chose whichever young ladies they fancied to join their harem. I think that may be the background to the testimony of this woman in the closing verses. "My own vineyard is mine to give," she says. It's her testimony that the kind of love affair which the Song of Songs has celebrated is only possible if it is a voluntary union, a free, self-giving response. "You can't buy love," she says. "All the money in the world won't buy love like this. Nor can you claim it like rent from one of Solomon's vineyards. My vineyard is mine to give," she says. Now, of course, parents have a legitimate role in advising their children about future partners. But it does seem to me this is one place in the Bible where there is a caution against any idea of marriage as anything other than a voluntary relationship. A wise parent will stop short of bullying tactics. For love is a precious and mysterious gift. You cannot switch it on to order. And any parents who don't understand that can't have a very successful marriage of their own, seems to me. I've just got one more thing to say about the Song of Solomon. I said last week that many, many commentators, both in the medieval period and among the Puritans in this country, treated the Song of Solomon as an allegory of the relationship between Jesus and the Christian believer. And as I said last week, whilst that was a very common and a very influential way of interpreting the book, one that shows itself in many of our hymns, for instance, it isn't really very satisfactory, because there's no evidence at all that the author of the Song of Solomon intended such an allegorical meaning in his writing. It's quite obviously, on the surface, nothing more than an erotic love song. And yet, there is just one reference in the New Testament which I personally believe may just give a little warrant to those Puritans and others who want to interpret the Song of Solomon, at least a little bit, allegorically. And it arises out of that lover's tiff that we began by talking about. Do you remember a verse in the book of Revelation that says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into them." I've always puzzled about where the imagery of that door comes from in Revelation, because almost all the imagery in the book of Revelation is drawn from the Old Testament, and I can only find one place that's in any way convincing. It's the Song of Solomon, chapter 5. That lover knocking on the door, wanting his wife to open it, and finding her reluctant with sleep. But here is Jesus knocking on the door of our lives, knocking on the door of our church, wanting to share with us the intimacy of a very special relationship. And does he find us, as he found the church at Laodicea, reluctant with sleep? "Behold, I stand at the door and knock," he says. "If anybody hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into them." Now, I don't think it is an allegory, but there is a sense in which the love between any man and woman that reaches anywhere near the Edenic ideal is a model of the love which Jesus has for us. Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. Let's pray together before we sing our closing hymn.